A mister can be a professor. Answer me that, Mr. Schmartypants. I sat down on a small rock, trying to work this out. My heart sank, for I knew almost immediately he had the better of me. I had simply thought his first name, like P.K., was a little unusual. I had never heard of anyone called Professor, but then I was also the first P.K. I knew of, so who was I to judge?
"I give up, sir,"
I said, feeling rather foolish.
"What is a professor?"
He had removed the canvas bag from his back and once again held the camera cupped in his hands.
"P.K., you are a genius, my friend. Look what we find under this rock where you're sitting. This is Allomicrosphigma."
I rose from the rock and joined him on his knees, looking underneath it. A small cluster of tiny spotted aloes, each not much bigger than a 2-shilling piece, grew in the grass at the base of the rock. Even at close quarters they would have been hard to see, and to an untrained eye almost impossible. The old man brushed the grass out of the way, and lying flat on his tummy he focused the camera on the tiny succulents. Behind him the sunset bathed the plants in a red glow.
"The light is perfect, but I must work quick."
His hands fumbling with the camera were shaking with excitement. Finally he clicked the shot and got slowly back to his knees. Removing a Joseph Rogers from the pocket of his overalls, he used the small knife to separate 4 of the aloes, leaving twice as many behind. He held the tiny plants in his hand for me to see.
"Wunderbar, P.K. Small but so perfect. A good omen for our friendship."
I must say I was not too impressed, but I was glad that he was happy.
"You haven't said what a professor is."
He wrapped the tiny aloes in his bandana and placed them carefully in his canvas bag, which he then slung back over his shoulders.
"Yeah, I like that. You have good concentration, P.K. What is a professor? That is a good question."
He stood looking at the dying sun.
"A professor is a person who drinks too much whiskey and once plays good Beethoven and Brahms and Mozart, and even sometimes when it was not serious, Chopin. Such a person who could command respect in Vienna, Leipzig, Warsaw, and Budapest, and also, yeah, once in London."
His shoulders sagged visibly.
"A professor is also some person who can not anymore command respect from little girls who play, not even chopsticks could."
I could see his previous mood of elation had changed, and there was a strange conversation going on in his head. But then, just as suddenly, his eyes regained their sparkle.
"A professor is a teacher, P.K. I have the honor to be a teacher of music."
He put his hand on my shoulder. It was the first time he had touched me, and the gesture was unthinking and friendly, like another kid might hold you when you're playing.
"You can call me Doc. You see, I'm also Doctor of Music. It is all the same thing. I'm too old and you're too young for Mr. This or Professor That. You and me will not hide behind such small importance. Just P.K. and Doc. I think this is a good plan?"
I nodded agreement, though I was too shy to say the word out loud. He seemed to sense my reluctance.
"What is my name, P.K.?"
he asked casually.
"Doc,"
I replied shyly. Hoppy was the only other adult with whom I'd been on such familiar terms, and I found it a little frightening.
100%. For this I give you 11 out of 10. Absolutely,
he said, and we both started to laugh. The sun sets quickly in the bushveld, and we hurried down the hill, small rocks rolling ahead of us as we raced to beat the dark. Below us the first lights were coming on. The chimneys were beginning to smoke as tired servants prepared supper for their white mistresses, before washing the dishes and going home to the native location.
"So it is you who live now in the English rose garden,"
Doc said when we reached the dark line of mulberry trees.
"Soon I will show you my cactus garden."
While it was too dark to see his face, I sensed his smile.
"We will meet again, my good friend P.K.
He touched me lightly, and I watched his tall, shambling figure with the Euphorbia grandicornis sticking up beyond his head, moving into the gathering darkness.
"Good night, Doc,"
I said. Then on a whim shouted,
"Euphorbia grandicornis and Allomicrosphigma."
The old man turned in the dark.
"Magnificent, P.K. Absoluto."
Euphorbia grandicornis. I rolled the name around in my head. Such a posh name for a silly old cactus with thorns. I wondered briefly how it might sound as a name for a fighter, but almost immediately rejected it. Euphorbia grandicornis was no name for the next welterweight champion of the world. When I entered the kitchen, Dunn and Dee averted their eyes, and Dee said,
"The mistress wants to see you, Nkosikan."
She looked at me distressed. Dunn walked over and reached out and touched me.
"We have put some food under your bed in the pot for night water," she whispered,
and they clutched each other and whimpered in their anxiety that they might be discovered. I knocked on the door of my mother's sewing room.
"Come in,"
she said, and looked up as I entered. Then she bent over her sewing machine and put her foot down on the motor and sewed away for quite a while. Of course, she did not know that she was dealing with a veteran of interrogation and punishment, and since I had suddenly grown up on the hill, I was uncrackable. A real hard case. After a while she stopped, and taking off her glasses, she rubbed the top of her nose with her forefinger and thumb, and gave a deep sigh.
"You have hurt me, and you have hurt the Lord very deeply," she said at last. "Don't you know the Lord loves you?"
She didn't wait for my answer.
"The Gospel says, 'Whosoever harms a hair upon the head of one of my little ones, harmeth me also.'"
I had heard the same thing said by Peak Porter, which just about confirmed everything I thought about the Lord. Peak Porter and my mother and Pastor Mulvery were all working for the same person. My mother continued,
"When I had my quiet time with the Lord this afternoon, he spoke to me. 'You will not get a beating, but he is not mocked, and you will go to your room at once without your supper.'"
"Yes, mother," I said, and turned to go.
"Just a moment. You have not apologized to me for your behavior."
Her eyes were suddenly sharp with anger. I hung my head just like I used to do with Mfro.
"I'm sorry, mother," I said.
"Not sorry enough, if you ask me. Do you think it's easy for me trying to make ends meet? I'm not supposed to get tired. I'm only your mother, the dog's body about the place. All you care about is that black woman, that stinking black Zulu woman."
She suddenly lost her anger, and her eyes filled with the tears of self-pity. Grabbing the dress she had been sewing, she held it up to her eyes, her thin shoulders shaking, and began to sob.
"I don't think I can take much more. First your grandfather, and then those two in the kitchen, and now you."
She looked up at me, her pretty face distorted and ugly from crying. Then with a sudden little wail, she once again buried her head in the dress and started to sob hysterically. I felt enormously relieved. This was much more like my old mother. She was having one of her turns, and I knew exactly what to do.
"I'll make you a nice cup of tea and an aspirin, and then you must have a good lie down," I said, and left the room.
Dum and Dee were delighted that I hadn't received a beating, and hurriedly made me a pot of tea, and then turned it around and around on the kitchen table to make it brew quickly. Dee handed me 2 aspirin from a big bottle kept in a cupboard above the sink, and I put them in my pocket, for I was afraid that if I put them on the saucer, I'd slop tea over them. My mother was sitting at the machine unpicking stitches as I entered the sewing room. Her eyes were red from crying, but otherwise she seemed quite composed. I put the cup of tea down carefully on the table next to the machine, and fished in my pocket for the aspirin, which I placed next to the cup.
"Thank you," she said in a tight voice, not looking up at me. "Now go straight to your room. You may not come out until morning."
It was light punishment. I had expected far worse. In the chamber pot, Dum and Dee had left 3 cold sausages, 2 big roast potatoes, and a couple of mandarins, a proper feast. There wasn't much else to do but go to sleep after that. It had been a long day and a very good one. The loneliness birds had flown away, and I had grown up and made a new friend called Doc, and had learned several new things. Euphorbia grandicornis was an ugly green cactus with long, dangerous-looking thorns. Aloe microsphigma was a tiny spotted aloe which liked to hide under rocks, and a professor was a teacher who taught music. Also there was a rose called Mrs. Butt, and another called Imperial Sunset. Tomorrow I would write a letter to Nanny and send her my 10 shillings. She would like that, and she would know that somebody loved her. I fell asleep, thinking about how big the hole would have to be to bury Big Hetty in, about hoppy-fighting Adolf Hitler, which would probably be an easier fight than the one against Jackhammer Smith. and how I was going to become welterweight champion of the world. 2 days later, I was sitting on the front stoop watching army trucks passing the front door, for I had discovered that an army camp was being set up in the valley about 3 miles out of town. The big khaki Bedford Chevrolet and Ford trucks, their backs covered with canvas tarpaulin canopies, had been passing for 2 days. Some contained soldiers who sat in the back carrying .303 rifles, but mostly they carried tents and timber and other things needed for building an army camp. My grandpa, when he heard the news on the wireless, had said it was typical of the army bigwigs putting a military camp at the end of a branch line, which couldn't move troops out fast enough to anywhere, least of all to Lorenzo Marques, where the Portuguese couldn't be relied on to maintain their neutrality for one moment. My Adolf Hitler fears returned immediately. Lorenzo Marques, I discovered, was no more than 80 miles away if they came through Swaziland. I was glad that my grandpa had Nanny's address in Zululand, and that I had sent her off a postal order for my 10 shillings, my love in a letter, and a photograph taken much earlier showing her holding me. If she couldn't get somebody to read the letter, she'd know it was from me, and my original escape plan would still be intact. I was also glad the army was so close at hand. Lorenzo Marques, the nearest seaport, was obviously where Adolf Hitler planned to march all the Roineks from these parts into the sea. Even an army at the end of a branch line was better than no army at all. My mother added that Lorenzo Marques was probably seething with German spies at this very moment, and they were probably using code words on Radio Lorenzo Marques to relay messages to the Boer Nazis who were plotting to tear down the country from within. I thought about the judge and Mr. Stoffel and how they always listened to the wireless. When my grandpa said that was a lot of poppycock, I was not so sure. I thought about these things as I watched a convoy of 105 army trucks go by, the biggest yet by far, so I didn't notice Doc coming up the hill until he almost reached the gate.
"Good morning, Piquet."
He was dressed in a white linen suit and wore a Panama hat, so that I hardly recognized him. He carried a string bag and a silver-handled walking stick, and under one arm was a large manila envelope.
"Good morning, Doc," I said, jumping to my feet.
I found it a little strange to say his name out loud, though in my head I'd said it 1,000 times.
"I can come in, yeah?"
I hurried down the steps to open the gate.
"This is an official visit, Piquet. I have come to see your mother."
I felt stupidly disappointed. I hadn't known he knew my mother. I followed him up the steps.
"You will introduce us, please," he said as we reached the veranda.
Unreasonably pleased that I was his first friend, I opened the front door and led him into the parlour. Visitors to the farm had been infrequent, but the routine was unerring. First you sat people down, and then you gave them coffee and cake. I asked Doc to sit down, and he did so, but not before he had stood in the centre of the zebra skin, and slowly turned around, taking the room in. When he reached the grandfather clock, he paused and said,
"English. London, about 1680. A very good piece."
He took a gold hunter from his fob pocket, and snapping it open, examined it briefly.
4 minutes a month," he said,
returning the watch to his pocket. I was amazed that he should know how much our grandfather clock lost, for he was right. I thought perhaps my grandpa had told him.
"Do you know my grandpa?"
I asked Doc.
"I have not yet had this pleasure, but it will be okay. We are both men of thorns. With me the cactus, with him the rose. The English and the Germans are not so far apart. It will be all right, you will see."
He said this just as I was about to leave the room to get Dum and Dee to bring coffee and cake. I was dumbfounded. Professor von Follenstein was a German? What should I do? My grandfather had gone to the library in town to change his books. That was one good thing, anyway. You never knew what he might do, coming face to face with a German. Although even against Doc, I didn't fancy his chances. I decided to say nothing to my mother. She might have a conniption on the spot. Dum and Dee had somehow known we had a guest, and were putting out the tea things and half a canary cake on a plate. I could hear the sewing machine zizzing away as I walked over to the far side of the house to tell my mother she had a guest. I knocked before opening the door.
"There's someone to see you, Mother,"
I shouted over the sound of the whirring machine. She stopped sewing and looked up.
"Tell her to come in, darling. It must be Mrs. Cameron about her skirt." "It is Professor von Fohlenstein. He wants to see you," I said in a low voice. "Professor whom?" she asked, removing her glasses and looking directly at me. "He's a teacher of music," I said urgently, in an attempt to hide my confusion. She rose to her feet and patted her hair and reached for her bag. From it she took a compact, and looking into the tiny mirror on the inside flap of the bag, hurriedly powdered her nose.
"Well, he can't teach music here. We haven't got that sort of money," she said,
putting the pad back into the compact and snapping it shut. I followed behind her, not at all sure of the reception Doc would get. But my mother was country-bred, and all visitors were treated courteously, no matter what their purpose. Doc rose from the lounge as she entered and extended his hand.
"Madame," he said, bowing slightly. "Professor Karl von Fohlenstein."
My mother extended her hand, and Doc took it lightly and bowed over it, bringing his heels together.
"Please sit down, Professor. Will you take coffee with us?"
She reached no higher than his waist, and when he sat down, her head was level with his.
"You are very kind, madam. Today, we have two things."
He reached into the string bag at his feet and produced a jam tin which held a small plant. The plant had only two leaves which stuck straight up out of the tin and were tinged with pink around the edges. They looked exactly like two light green rabbit ears.
"Allow me, please, to introduce Calancho tierziflora, quite rare in these parts, often mistaken for a plant, but I assure you, madame, a true cactus."
Doc handed the jam tin to my mother, who remarked that she couldn't possibly remember the name and laughed her nervous laugh.
"Yeah, it is a difficult name, but if you wish, you may just call it rabbit ears," the doc said charitably,
though he somehow left the impression the little cactus was demeaned by such a common name. Dum and Dee entered, Dee carrying a tray with cups and cake, and Dum carrying the china coffee pot we used for visitors. Dee set the tray on the traymobile and carefully wheeled it over to my mother, who sent her back to fetch a knife for the cake. Dum, keeping her back straight and her arm rigid, bent her knees almost to the ground so she could put the coffee pot down on the traymobile without any possibility of spilling it. Dum, too, was sent back to the kitchen for the coffee strainer.
"You can tell them 100 times over, it's useless. I don't know what goes on inside their heads," my mother sighed, putting the tiny plant on the shelf under the traymobile.
I had been standing beside her chair, and now she turned to me.
"Run along now."
Doc looked up.
"With your permission, madame, I would like for P.K. to stay, please."
"Who?"
my mother said.
"Your son, madame. I would much like him to stay."
My mother turned to me.
"What on earth have you been telling the professor? Who is P.K.?" "It's my new name. I haven't told you about it yet," I said, flustered.
My mother laughed, but I knew she was annoyed.
"Why, you have a perfectly good name, my dear."
She gave me a funny look, then turned to Doc.
"Of course you may stay, but I'm afraid our family never had much of an ear for music, and lessons would be much too expensive."
Without looking at Dee and Dum, who had re-entered the room and now stood behind her, she held her hand out for the knife and strainer, and dismissed them with an impatient flick of her head.
"I am most grateful, madame."
My mother lifted the coffee pot.
"Black only, no sugar,"
Doc said, leaning forward in anticipation. My mother poured his coffee.
"A nice piece of cake, Professor?"
Doc put his hand up in refusal.
"Thank you,"
he said. It was a speech habit I was going to find hard to get used to, saying thank you when he meant no thank you. And clearly my mother misunderstood him, for she placed a piece of the canary cake on a side plate and handed it to him with his coffee. He accepted the cake without further protest. Doc put the coffee and cake on the zebra hide between his legs and picked up the manila envelope.
"And so now we have the second thing."
His eyes sparkled as he handed the envelope to my mother.
"Goodness, what can it be?" she said,
pulling out the tucked-in flap of the large brown envelope. She withdrew the largest photograph I had ever seen, which to my amazement turned out to be me sitting on the rock on top of the hill.
"Goodness gracious."
My mother stared at it, momentarily lost for words. The photograph showed every detail, even the lichen on the rock, more clearly than any I had seen before. Shafts of sunlight shining through a silver-edged cloud seemed to be directed straight at the rock on which I sat. My body, half in shadow, appeared to be as one with the rock. I didn't know it at the time, but it was an extraordinary picture. At last my mother spoke.
"Wherever did you take this? It is so sad. Why did you take a picture of him when he was looking sad?"
Doc rubbed his chin. It was plainly not the comment he expected, and he needed a moment to think about the answer. Ignoring the first question, he leant forward as he answered the second.
"Yeah, this is so. Only one great picture shows a man when he smiles. Franz Hals, Laughing Cavalier, early 17th century."
He pointed at the grandfather clock.
"Around that time they made this clock also. The smile, madame, is used by humans to hide the truth. The artist is only interested to reveal the truth."
He leant back, clearly satisfied with his reply.
"Goodness, Professor, all that is much too deep for simple country people like us. He is only a very little boy, you know. I prefer him to smile."
"Of course. But sadness, like understanding, comes early in life for some. It is part of intelligence."
My mother's back stiffened.
"You seem to know a lot about my son, Professor. I can't imagine how. He has only been home from boarding school for 3 days.
Doc clapped his hands gleefully.
"Boarding school. Ha! That explains, I think, everything. For a boy like this, boarding school is a prison, yeah?"
My mother was beginning to show her impatience. Her fingers tapped steadily on the arms of the chair, a sure sign that things were not going well.
"We had no choice in the matter, Professor. I was ill. One does the best one can under the circumstances."
She looked into her lap, her coffee untouched. Doc suddenly seemed to realize that he had gone too far.
"Forgive me, madame."
He leant forward.
"It is not said to make you angry. Your son is a gifted child. I don't know where, I don't know how. I only pray it is music. Today I have come to ask you, please, madame, let me teach him."
He had spoken to my mother softly and with great charm, and I could feel her relax as his voice stroked her ego.
"I must say you seem to know more about him than his mother. I can't see how he is any different to any other child of his age,"
she said huffily, though I could tell this was just a pretense, and that she was secretly pleased by the compliment. My mother was a proud woman and didn't expect charity from anyone.
"It is out of the question. Piano lessons don't grow on trees, Professor."
"Yeah, that is true. But I think maybe on cactus plants."
Doc's deep blue eyes showed his amusement.
"For 2 years I have searched for the Allomicros figma. From here, there, everywhere. Then, poof, just by sitting on a rock, Allomicros figma comes. The boy is a genius. Absoluto."
"Whatever can you be talking about, Professor? What have you two been up to?"
Whereas before she had been angry, now she was plainly charmed by him.
"Madame, we met on the mountaintop with only the face of God above us. The picture will capture the moment forever."
He shrugged his scrawny shoulders.
"It was destiny. The new cactus man has come."
My mother seemed unsure how to take this.
"I am a born-again Christian, Professor. God's name is only used in praise in this house," she said,
mostly to cover her confusion, but also as a caution to Doc not to assume an over-familiar manner with the Almighty.
"God and I have no quarrels, madame. The Almighty conceived the cactus plant. If God would choose a plant to represent him, I think he would choose of all plants the cactus. The cactus has all the blessings he tried, but mostly failed to give to man. Let me tell you how. It has humility, but it is not submissive. It grows where no other plant will grow. It does not complain when the sun bakes its back, or the wind tears it from the cliff, or drowns it in the dry sand of the desert, or when it is thirsty. When the rains come, it stores water for the hard times to come. In good times and in bad, it will still flower. It protects itself against danger, but it harms no other plant. It adapts perfectly to almost any environment. It has patience and enjoys solitude. In Mexico, there's a cactus that flowers only once every 100 years, and at night. This is saintliness of an extraordinary kind, would you not agree? The cactus has properties that heal the wounds of men, and from it come potions that can make man touch the face of God or stare into the mouth of hell. It is the plant of patience and solitude, love and madness, ugliness and beauty, toughness and gentleness. Of all plants, surely God made the cactus in his own image. It has my enduring respect. It is my passion.
He paused and pointed to the little green plant in the jam tin.
Calancho Tirziflora. Such a shy little lady. 2 years I searched to find her. Now she grows happily in my cactus garden, where her big ears listen to all the gossip.
I'm sure that's all very nice, Professor, but what does it all mean?
My mother said. I could see she was confused, not knowing whether, in the end, Doc had praised or blasphemed God.
My eyes are not so good. If the boy will come with me to collect cactus specimens, I will teach him music. It is a fine plan, yeah? Cactus for Mozart.
My mother looked pleased, as though a new thought had come into her head.
His grandmother was very creative, an artist, you know. But I don't know if there were any musicians in the family. Perhaps Dad will know.
She pointed to the 2 rose pictures on either side of the bookcase.
Her work, she said modestly. She only ever painted roses.
Doc did not turn to look at the pictures.
When I came in, I saw them already. Very good.
The idea of a musician in the family was clearly to my mother's liking. The Boers are a naturally musical people, and any excuse for a gathering brought out the concertinas and guitars, and even an occasional violin. In my mother's eyes, it was their sole redeeming feature. The idea of a son who played the piano, let alone classical music, was a social triumph of the sort she had never expected to come her way. Even in this largely English-speaking town, a classical piano player in the family was a social equalizer almost as good as money. I was to learn that the Apostolic Faith Mission, who believed in being born again, baptism by immersion, the gift of speaking in tongues and faith healing, was deemed pretty low on the social scale. Barberton was not the sort of town which encouraged the crying out in prayer or sudden spontaneous religious combustion from the floor of a charismatic church. My mother was constantly fighting the need to remain loyal to the Lord and his religiously garrulous congregation, while at the same time aspiring to the ranks of nice people. Old Piscop at the piano promised to be the major instrument in balancing the family social scales. The bargain was struck, just as Mrs. Cameron arrived for her fitting. In return for trekking around the hills as Doc's constant companion, I would receive free piano lessons. I had to work very hard on my camouflage to contain my delight. While I had no concept of what it meant to be musical, from the very beginning pitch and harmony had been part of my life with Nanny. The long summer months were spent mostly with Doc, climbing the hills around Barberton. Often we would venture into the dark kloofs where the hills formed the deep creases at the start of the True Mountains. These green moist gullies of tree fern and tall old yellow wood trees, the branches draped with beard lichen and the vines of wild grape, made a cool dark contrast to the barren, sun-baked hills of aloe, thorn scrub, rock, and coarse grass. Occasionally we saw a lone ironwood tree rising magnificently above the canopy. These relics had escaped the axes of the miners who had roamed these hills 50 years before in search of gold. The mountains were dotted with shafts sunk into the hills and mountainside, dark pits and passages supported by timber, which before it was consigned to the tunnels may have stood for 1,000 years. Doc taught me the names of the flowering plants. The sugar bush with its splashy white blossoms. A patch of brilliant orange-red seen in the distance usually meant wild pomegranate. I learned to differentiate between species of tree fuchsia, to stop and crush the leaves of the camphor bush and breathe its beautiful aromatic smell. I recognized the pale yellow blossoms of wild gardenia and the blooms of the water alder. Monkey rope strung from tall trees, draped with club moss, was given names such as Traveller's Joy, Lemon Capers, Climbing Saffron, Milk Rope, and David's Roots. Nothing escaped Doc's curiosity, and he taught me the priceless lesson of identification. Soon trees and leaves, bush, vine, and lichen began to assemble in my mind in a schematic order as he explained the nature of the ecosystems of bush and clough and high mountain.
Everything fits, BK. Nothing is unexplained. Nature is a chain reaction. One thing follows the other. Everything is dependent on something else. The smallest is as important as the largest. See, he would say, pointing to a tiny vine curled around a sapling. That is a stinkwood sapling which can grow 30 meters. But the vine will win, and the tree will be choked to death long before it will ever see the sky.
He would often use an analogy from nature.
Yeah, BK. Always in life, an idea starts small. It is only a sapling idea, but the vines will come, and they will try to choke your idea, so it cannot grow, and it will die, and you will never know you had a big idea. An idea so big it could have grown 30 meters through the dark canopy of leaves, and touched the face of the sky.
He looked at me and continued.
The vines are people who are afraid of originality, of new thinking. Most people you encounter will be vines. When you are a young plant, they are very dangerous.
His piercing blue eyes looked into mine.
Always listen to yourself, PK. It is better to be wrong than simply to follow convention. If you are wrong, no matter, you have learned something and you will grow stronger. If you are right, you have taken another step towards a fulfilling life.
He would sigh and squint at me.
Ah. Experts. What did I tell you about experts, PK?
You can't always go by expert opinion. A chicken, if you ask a chicken, should be stuffed with grasshoppers, mealies and worms.
Even after repeating it 100 times, I still thought it was funny. Or Doc would show me how a small lick of water trickling from a rock face would, drop by drop, gather around its wet apron, fern and then scrub and later trees and vines, until the clough became an independent network of plant, insect, bird, and animal life.
Always you should go to the source, to the face of the rock, to the beginning. The more you know, the more you can control your destiny. Man is the only animal who can store knowledge outside his body. This has made him greater than the creatures around him. Everything has happened before. If you know what comes before, then you know what happens now. Your brain, PK, has 2 functions. It is a place for original thought, but it is also a reference library. Use it to tell you where to look, and then you will have for yourself all the brains that have ever been.
Doc never talked down. Much of what he said would take me years to understand, but I soaked it up nevertheless, storing it in my awkward young mind where it could mature and later come back to me. He taught me to read for meaning and information, to make margin notes and to follow these up with trips to the Barberton Library, where Mrs. Boxall would give a great sigh when the two of us walked in.
Oh, here come the mess pots.
She claimed she had to spend hours erasing the penciled margin notes in the books we borrowed. Doc once insisted they made the books more valuable, and Mrs. Boxall arched an eyebrow.
Written in German and in kindergarten, Professor?
Doc shrugged, looking up from his book and removing his gold-rimmed reading glasses.
Kindergarten. That is also written in German, Madame Boxall.
But I don't think Mrs. Boxall really minded. The books on birds and insects and plants were seldom borrowed by anyone else, and besides, as most of the books in the natural history section had once belonged to him, Doc adopted a proprietorial attitude towards the town library. Over the years, his tiny cottage had become too small to contain them all, and they had been bequeathed to the library, which now acted, in Doc's mind anyway, as a bibliographical outpost to his cottage. Doc also taught me Latin roots, so I was no longer forced to resort to memory alone, and the botanical names of plants began to make sense to me. We climbed the high kranzes and the crags in search of cactus and succulents. Towards the end of summer, on the side of a mountain scarred by loose grey shale and tufts of coarse brown grass, I stumbled on Aloe brevifolia, a tiny thorny aloe. Doc was overjoyed.
Gold! Absolute gold!
He jumped into the air and upon landing missed his footing on the shaly surface and fell arse over tip down the mountain, coming to a halt just short of a 200-foot drop. He climbed gingerly back, hands bleeding from clutching at the sharp shale, a sheepish grin on his weather-beaten face, but the triumph of the rare find still showed in his excited eyes.
Brevifolia in these parts. So high, impossible. You're a genius, PK. Absolute.
It was the find of the summer, and to Doc worth all the weary hours spent on the hills and in the mountains. We recorded the find with the camera, and removed six of the tiny plants, leaving double that number clinging precariously to the inhospitable mountainside. Like me, Doc was an early riser, so just after dawn all that summer he gave me piano lessons.
In 1 year we will tell, but it is not so important. To love music is everything. First I will teach you to love music. After this, slowly we shall learn to play.
I was anxious to please Doc and worked hard, but I suspect he knew almost from the outset that I wouldn't prove an especially gifted musician. My progress, while superior to that of the small girls he was obliged to teach for a living, indicated a very modest talent. In the years that followed, it was enough to fool my mother and all the big-bosomed matriarchs who rule the town's important families. At concerts, which, I hasten to add, were not in my honour, I represented the cultured element, and they would applaud me deliberately and loudly. These occasions, which occurred in the spring and autumn, made my mother very proud, though they also represented a compromise with the Lord. Concerts were the devil's work, and very much against the Lord's teaching. They were just the sort of thing which, like money-lending, the Lord had clearly condemned when he castigated the Pharisees and Sadducees in the Temple of Jerusalem. She justified my participation and her attendance by pointing out to herself, mostly, that many of the great classical musicians wrote music for the church. The Lord's will was equally explicit on drinking and smoking, the bioscope and dancing, except ballet. Ballet was another of the items cherished by the lavender-scented ladies from the town's upper echelon families, and the ballet performance usually preceded my piano recital. Together they made up the cultural component of the twice-yearly concert. Chopin by Yours Truly and Tchaikovsky's Dance of the Swans by gramophone record, danced to by six-year-old neophytes in white tutus and duck-billed headdresses made of papier-mâché. We were the cultural meat in a popular sandwich, otherwise liberally filled with amateur vaudeville acts, solo songs of an Irish nature, single or combined concertina, piano accordion and guitar renditions of well-known Afrikaans folk songs, usually performed by the Afrikaner warders from the prison. To address the racial balance, a Gilbert and Sullivan male quartet would generally follow. One English comic opera song was reckoned by the concert committee to equate roughly with a dozen Afrikaans folk songs, no matter how pleasingly syncopated, harmonized, toe-tappin' and hand-clappin' they might prove to be. The concert would always end with the All Saints Anglican Church Choir singing White Cliffs of Dover, with the audience joining in. To show the Roynack majority where their unspoken loyalty lay, the warders and their families would leave the town hall prior to the mass rendition of White Cliffs. This would be accompanied by some booing and catcalls from less well-bred members of the remaining audience. Germany had covertly helped the Boers during the Boer War. Apart from arms and ammunition sold for profit, she had donated food and medical supplies, and had even sent medical orderlies and doctors to the harassed Boers, who, due to the British scorched earth policy, were dying less from the aim of the British Lee Metfords than from a land which could no longer feed them. To the Boers, Germany was an old and trusted friend in a country where a contract was a handshake and declared friendship a bond that continued beyond the grave. Antisemitism in the Dutch Reformed Church, where Jews were thought of as Christ-killers, had always existed, and the concept of the superiority of some races over others was never for one moment in doubt. In this context, to many Boers Adolf Hitler was only doing his job, and to some minds doing it damn well. After the warders and other Nazi sympathizers had walked out, the remainder of the audience would stand up, lock arms and sing White Cliffs of Dover at least twice to confirm doubly their love for a Britain facing her darkest hour. To bring the concert to a tearful close, the concert party, with warders and other Afrikaners missing, would gather on the stage, each of us holding a long-stemmed rose delivered earlier by me as a sign of our family's inherent good breeding. With the misty-eyed audience fresh from the mawkishly sentimental journey to a country most of us would never see, we stood to rigid attention while a scratchy 78 RPM rendered God Save the King. Whereupon the cast hurled the long-stemmed roses into the audience. My grandpa, my mother and I then walked home, having politely refused the mayor's invitation to the traditional post-concert party for the cast at the Phoenix Hotel. Worldly parties typified by one such as this, where drinking, smoking and dancing took place, were pretty high up on the Lord's banned list. The next issue of the Goldfields News would report the concert with the warder walkout splashed across the front page. Tongues wagged for days. Important people suggested the military be brought in to wipe out this nest of Nazi vipers, or that the prison be moved to Nelspruit, an Afrikaans town 40 miles away, where most of the prisoners probably came from in the first place. My grandpa, with his experience in fighting the Boers, had once been canvassed for his opinion by Mr. Hankin, the editor of the Goldfields News. But they didn't print what he said. What he said was, "I spent most of the Boer War shitting my britches as a stretcher-bearer. The only thing those buggers do better than music is shoot. Without them, the concert wouldn't be worth a cardboard boot." Maybe Mr. Hankin thought his newspaper gave the family enough publicity, because he never again asked my grandpa for his opinion on anything, even though the prison warders did the same thing at every concert for the duration of the war. Mrs. Boxall, who was the town's correspondent on matters cultural, could always be relied on to devote most of her column, clippings from a cultured garden by Fiona Boxall, to my performance. For days after, it appeared my mother was in a state of dazed euphoria, and I was conscripted to deliver a bunch of roses to the library twice a week for a month. In the process of keeping faith with my mother, Doc instilled in me an abiding love for music. What my clumsy hands could never play, I could hear quite clearly in my head. A love of music was among his many gifts to me, perhaps the most important of them all. And he continued to teach me, even after his calm and gentle life was thrown into turmoil. And the joy of being alone with him on the high cliffs and kranzes was stolen from my childhood. 10. I had been enrolled at the local school when the new term began at the end of January. 6 was the starting age for grade 1. But after a few days it was clear that my year spent in a mixed-age class at boarding school had put me well ahead of the rest of the kids. I was pushed up to grade 3, where I easily held my own against kids 2 years older than me. During the judge's arithmetic, my early grounding in reading, a comprehensive understanding of Afrikaans in a classroom of English-speaking kids coming without enthusiasm to the language for the first time, and Doc's demand from our first day that I write up my field notes, all gave me a hugely unfair advantage. I might possibly have been elevated even further, but for the embarrassment it would have caused. I quickly earned a reputation, rather unjustly, for being clever. Doc had persuaded me to drop my camouflage and not to play dumb. "To be smart is not a sin. But to be smart and not use it, that, PK, is a sin. Absolutely." I had needed little encouragement. Under his direction, my mind was constantly hungry, and I soon found the schoolwork tedious and simplistic. Doc became my real teacher, and school was simply time spent between 8 and 1 o'clock when I would rush from the classroom to his cottage, hidden in the cactus garden. His thorny garden was a never-ending source of delight. It was half an acre on the more or less flat top of a small hill which overlooked the town and valley. A 10-minute climb to solitude, up a little dirt and rock road that led nowhere else. His cactus garden may well have been the best private collection of cacti and succulents in the world. I, who grew to be an expert on cacti, have never seen a better one. Doc's cottage had 3 rooms and a lean-to kitchen. The 3 rooms were called the music room, the book room, and the whiskey room, each having its specified purpose: music, study, and drinking himself to sleep. For in all things, even in drunkenness, Doc had a tidy mind. And the first year we spent together, I never once witnessed him drunk. Though when I arrived just after dawn for my music lesson, I often had to wake him, whereupon he would stumble outside to retch and cough. Then he would come to sit beside the Steinway, his blue eyes red-rimmed and dulled from the previous night's whiskey, his long fingers wrapped around the enamel mug of bitter black coffee I had made him on the Primus. Doc never talked about drinking. All he would sometimes say as I set my music out on the big Steinway was,
"Pianissimo, Piquet. The wolves were howling in my head last night."
I would look through my music for something soft and easy on the nerves. Perhaps this is why, as I grew older and more proficient, I seemed more attracted to playing Chopin. There's a great deal less fortissimo in a Chopin étude than in Liszt or Brahms, and Doc's early morning hangovers may, over that first year, have somehow inclined me to softer music. It was the cactus garden which testified to his problem with Dr. Bottle, as my mother would call any person who ever held strong drink to their lips. Bordering both sides of the path for 100 yards through the cactus garden were embedded Johnny Walker bottles, their square bases shining in the sun like parallel silver snakes, winding around the cactus and aloe and blazing orange and pink portulaca. Each bottle represented an attempt to obviate some private torture. Doc made no apology for his drinking. He seldom even mentioned it, and when he did, it was always blamed quietly and politely on the wolves, which I imagined slavering away, great red tongues lolling, gnashing teeth, chomping up Doc's brains. It was at sunset on a Saturday afternoon late in January 1941, a little more than a year after Doc and I had first met on the hill behind the Rose Garden. We'd spent the day in the hills and had almost arrived back at Doc's cottage. We'd found a patch of Senecio serpens high up in a dry kloof, growing over the tailings of an old digging. It was a nice find, although blue chalk sticks, as they are commonly called, are not too rare unless they flower in an unusual colour. We had decided to plant them in the cactus garden and wait until they flowered again. That was the magic of the cactus garden. Some succulents can play dumb. A common blue chalk stick can turn from a Cinderella into a princess in front of your very eyes. I was the first to notice the army van with the white stenciled military police on its hood. The van was parked directly in front of the whiskey bottle path which led to the cottage, hidden from view amongst the tall cactus. Two men leant against the front mudguard smoking, their red-banded khaki caps resting on the hood of the van, which had been turned to face down the hill. Doc was explaining the differences between the genus Senecio serpens and the lighter-coloured Glottophyllum uncatum, banging his long hiking stick into the ground as he walked, and getting generally excited, as he did when his mind was absorbed in esoteric botanical detail. The two men saw us approach, and dropping their cigarettes, ground them underfoot. Clearing their throats almost simultaneously, they reached for their caps, carefully placed them back on their heads the way men do when they are about to undertake an unpleasant duty. Both wore khaki bush shirts, shorts, brown boots, puttees and khaki stockings, though one of them wore the polished Sam Brown belt of an officer, while the other, a sergeant, wore a white webbing one. The officer stepped right in front of Doc, who stopped and looked up in surprise. Doc was taller than the officer by at least a foot, so the military man was obliged to look up at him. He had a thin black pencil moustache, just like Pete Porter, and although he was not standing to attention, his body seemed permanently rigid. From the top pocket of his tunic, he removed a piece of paper which he held up.
"Good afternoon, sir. You are Karl von Follenstein? Professor Karl von Follenstein?"
he asked in a sententious voice.
"Yeah, this is me,"
Doc said, surprised that anyone would question so obvious a fact. The officer cleared his throat and proceeded to read from the paper he held in front of him.
"Under the Aliens Act of 1939 and by the authority vested in me by the Provost Marshal of the South African Armed Forces, I arrest you. You are charged with conspiracy to undermine the security of a nation at war."
He handed the paper to Doc.
"You will have to come with me, sir. The civilian police, under the direction of military security, will search your premises and you will be detained at Barberton Prison until your case can be heard."
To my surprise, Doc made no protest. His face was sad as he looked down at the officer, and handed him back the piece of paper without even glancing at it. He raised his head to look over the officer and passed where the sergeant was standing next to the van, his gaze following the line of the cactus garden. He turned slowly, his eyes filled with pain, taking in the hills, the marvelous allodotted hills, his Garden of Eden for 20 years in the Africa he so savagely loved. Finally he turned to look over the town, across the valley to the sun beginning to dip behind the escarpment.
Their stupidity. Already their stupidity begins again, he said softly.
Then turning to me, he patted my shoulder.
You must plant the Senecio serpents to get the morning sun. They like that.
He removed his bush hat and absent-mindedly put it on the roof of the van. He got his red bandana from his overalls and slowly wiped his face and sniffed into it and pushed his nose around before returning it to the pocket of his overalls. Then he lifted his bush hat from the roof of the van and put it on my head. I looked up at him in surprise. Doc didn't play that sort of childish game. But his eyes were sad, and his voice soft, barely above a whisper.
So, now you are the boss of the Cactus Garden, PK.
I wanted to cry, and I think Doc wanted to as well. But we didn't. We both knew enough not to share our feelings in front of the military. Turning to the officer, Doc said,
You will please allow me first to shave and change my clothes. A man must go to prison in his best clothes.
The officer rolled his eyes heavenwards. From the number of cigarette butts on the ground, they'd been waiting for some time, and he obviously wanted to get going.
All right, Professor, but make it snappy.
Turning to the sergeant in an official manner, he rapped,
Sergeant! Escort the prisoner to his house for kit change and ablutions.
We walked slowly down the whiskey bottle path, and Doc dropped his canvas shoulder bag on the open veranda. I followed him into the dark little cottage.
Do not light the lamps, PK. The light is soft, and we will soon be gone.
I followed him to the lean-to kitchen, where he placed an enamel basin on the hard earth floor, and poured water into it from a jug. I took the jug and refilled it from the rainwater tank behind the cottage. Doc's cottage, isolated from the town by a small hill, had no running water. He stripped down in the lean-to kitchen, and using a loofah, washed himself from head to toe. I brought him the fresh jug of water, and stepping out of the lean-to into the garden, he stood beside a tall cactus and poured it over his head, giving the cactus the benefit of the overflow. Then he wiped himself briskly with an almost threadbare towel. He was brown all over, for we often lay on a rock in the hills to sun ourselves after a swim in a mountain creek. His thin body was hard and sinewy, and the snowy-white hair on his chest seemed incongruous. I had seen my grandpa nude, and while he too was a thin man, he didn't have the same hard-as-nails look. The sergeant had grown impatient, waiting around the kitchen, and had wandered into the music room where he was playing chopsticks on the Steinway. Doc seemed not to hear as he shaved carefully, stropping his cutthroat razor for ages until it was perfect. Then he dressed slowly in his white linen suit and black boots. Finally, he placed a spare shirt and his shaving things in a sugar bag, and walking through to the book room, he selected a large book from the very top shelf of one of the bookshelves, which he had constructed from bricks and pineboard planks.
Put it also in the bag, PK.
I took the large leather-bound volume from him and looked at the spine. It was an old book whose maroon leather binding was scuffed and mottled with rough brown leather spots, showing through the once smooth and polished cover. The title, embossed on the spine, was hard to read as the gold had mostly worn away, leaving only the pale embossing. It read, Cactaceae, Africa und Amerika, K.J. von Vollenstein. I opened the heavy book to find that it was written in German. I walked into the whiskey room, where Doc had left the sugar bag, and using the edge of the blanket on the small hard bed, I wiped the dust from the cover of the book and put it in the bag. On the packing case dresser next to the bed was half a bottle of Johnny Walker, and this too I put in the bag. Then heaving it over my shoulder, I joined Doc, who was standing at the front door. He removed his Panama hat from a hook on the wall, and picked up his silver-handled walking stick, leaning in a corner behind the door.
"We are ready, sir,"
he said, turning slowly to the sergeant a few feet away in the music room. The sergeant rose from the piano stool.
"That's a bloody good piano you got there, Professor. Once in the bioscope I saw this film star dance on the top of a piano just like this one, only it was all white. I think it was Greta Garbo, but I'm not sure."
He took a last look around the cottage.
"Okay, man, let's go."
He took the sugar bag from my shoulder and looked into it.
"Hey, what's this? You can't take whiskey where you're going. Are you stupid or something?"
I started to apologize, but he checked me with his hand and grinned.
"If you like, we can have a quick spot now, Obaz,"
he said to Doc.
"Who knows when you'll get another chance, eh?"
He gave him a conspiratorial wink and uncorked the bottle. Raising it to his lips, he took a long drag of whiskey. He winced as he withdrew the bottle from his mouth, then wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and the top of the bottle with the palm of his hand.
"Lecker, man, that's bloody good whiskey. No use leaving it lying around, eh?"
He handed the bottle to Doc, who raised his hand in refusal.
"Come on, don't be stupid, man. It's going to be a long time between drinks. Better make the most of it."
He held it towards Doc after taking another long swig. In two goes, he had reduced the whiskey to less than a quarter of a bottle. Doc took the bottle of Johnny Walker and held it briefly to his lips without opening his mouth before handing it back. The sergeant shrugged.
"Suit yourself, man. All the more for me, it's bloody good whiskey, who knows. Tomorrow maybe we're all dead."
He took another long swig and walked over to the piano.
"In this film, this man was playing the piano like at a funeral. Then it drunk tipped some whiskey on it, and suddenly it was playing like mad."
He tipped the remaining whiskey over the keys of the Steinway. Doc, who had been standing passively waiting, seemed to come alive. He raised his stick and rushed at the sergeant.
"Schweinhund! Do not defile the instrument of Beethoven, Brahms, Bach, and Liszt!"
He brought his cane down hard onto the sergeant's wrist, and the bottle fell from his hand to smash on the cement floor. Gripping his wrist, the sergeant danced in agony amongst the broken glass. Doc, using the sleeve of his linen jacket, ran his arms across the keys in an attempt to wipe them and sent the piano into a glissando. Then he turned and walked towards the front door.
"You fucking Nazi bastard!"
the sergeant yelled. I hurried after Doc and he caught up with us on the path outside the cottage.
"I'll show you, you child fucker!"
He was trying to remove a pair of handcuffs from his belt as he ran.
"Stop, you're under military arrest!"
But Doc, his head held high, simply continued down the path towards the van. The sergeant grabbed Doc's arm and clicked a handcuff around his compliant wrist. Doc seemed hardly to notice and just kept walking, obliging the sergeant to hang on to the other handcuff as though he were being dragged along like a prisoner. He took a swinging kick at Doc, knocking his legs from under him and bringing the old man to his knees on the path. In his fury and humiliation, he aimed a second kick. Just as screaming, I flung myself at his legs. The army boot intended for Doc's ribs caught me under the chin, knocking me unconscious. I awoke in Barberton Hospital with a man in a white coat shining a torch into my eyes. My head was ringing as though voices came from the other end of a long tunnel.
"Well, thank God for that. He's regained consciousness," I heard him say.
"Thank you, Jesus,"
I heard my mother say in a weepy voice. I looked around to see her seated at the side of the bed. She looked pale and worried, and her hair hung in wisps around her eyes, for she had come out without her hat and still wore her pink sewing smock. My grandpa was also there, sitting on a chair at the opposite side of the bed. I tried to talk, but found it impossible, and my jaw hurt like billy-o. I managed a weak grunt without opening my mouth, but that was all. My mouth tasted of blood, and running my swollen tongue around my palate, I realized that several of my teeth were missing. The doctor spoke to me.
"Now, son, I want you to tell me how many fingers I'm holding up in front of you."
He held up two, and I held up two fingers.
"Again."
He held up four fingers, and I too held up four. He repeated this with several combinations before he finally said,
"Well, that's something anyway. He doesn't appear to have concussion. We'll have to x-ray the jaw, though.
I think it's probably broken. He turned to my mother and grandpa. The boy is in a lot of pain. We'll be taking